This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Terrorism and immigration issues converge. The U.S. is to establish a foothold in Gaza, and Biden introduces a budget already. Those stories and more. The Monica Perez Show starts now. Hey guys, this is Monica Perez. Got a few things to let you know about. If you want to hear this show in full, live, and commercial-free, as well as participate in the chat at the bottom of the hour, then listen Tuesdays and Thursdays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern on YouTube, Rockfin, Rumble, other stuff too, Facebook, Instagram. And if you're not listening there, you can listen to the podcast on your favorite podcasting platform, and you can listen to that commercial-free if you hit the premium feed on iTunes. I'm having a 30-day free trial there right now. And see if you like the show a whole lot better without the commercials. I think you will. So thanks so much for tuning in. First story, I have noticed that there is a lot of stories about terrorism and immigration. So this is not just in the U.S., it's also in Europe. I noticed it the other day because I heard numerous times on Fox there was someone on the terrorist watch list had crossed the Mexican border. And I'm thinking, like, what does that even mean? But after I heard it like four times on Fox headlines or whatever, I thought this is more than I've heard them mention the Lake and Riley murder and the undocumented illegal immigrant who is being held for her murder, and there are witnesses against this guy. That seemed to not get as much press as this one guy on the terrorist watch list. And that seemed to me because the terrorist watch list story was propaganda gearing us up for fears of terrorism crossing the border. And I actually stumbled upon an article on Cato where the author, it was a recent incident, similar, not the same person. The person on the terrorist watch list this time had a Hispanic name. I forget what it was, but, I don't think it was saying it was Islamic terrorism. And what the Cato article said, which I'll put in the show notes, which you can find at monicaperezshow.com, is that the terrorist watch list is basically not for people who have committed acts of terrorism. That those people are on a wanted list, basically. If you're on a terrorist watch list, they may or may not have actual reasons to suspect you of potential terrorism. So they can basically just put you on that list. And then I believe you do get deported, which, I'm not complaining about that. The immigration policy is so screwed up. I'm not going to get into the fine points of that. I have myself been on a no-fly list, so I know how arbitrary that can be. And it was not me. They knew it wasn't me. It was a different person's birthday. But I could not fly. They would stall me for so long that I would miss flights. And then I just went back to my maiden name for purposes of flying, and the problem went away. But so I know how arbitrary that can be and how not scary. I think the Cato article said no one ever detained for having been on the terrorist watch list was ever prosecuted for terrorism. So he anticipates that these people are not being prosecuted, which means they're probably not that much of a threat. They're not the biggest problem with that. And I figured, well, maybe it's just election year stuff. But there are other things that are also going on with this, and it's the same theme that's coming to Europe. And I kind of anticipated this for several reasons, especially the Israel, thing with Gaza. I don't know. They keep calling it the Israel-Hamas war, but until I see two armies lined up against each other, I'm not calling it a war. But what's happening in Gaza right now, because it got so much press on both sides. I've talked about how weird I think that is, or how suspicious it is to have a lot of pro-Palestinian stuff, which has never really gotten a lot of airtime before, now gets the airtime. And I thought, well, why are they pumping up the Palestinian side? At the same time, they defend the Israel side. And I thought, well, maybe they're going to unleash another wave of refugees into Europe from Palestine or Palestinian sympathizers, but really like the problems in Palestine, if they let some of those people out, they, you know, it'll be a flood, I'm sure. And the idea being, you have people then who are immigrants who aren't choosing to be there. The Western governments, let's say, are all complicit or responsible, like in the minds of, say, the European population. So you say, okay, here are these refugees who are mad at us, whom we displaced, whom we have a humanitarian obligation towards, but they hate us. So you have to like super surveil and screen over the border because a lot of them or some of them are going to be terrorists, or we need to spend a lot of money on these people. We need to lower our standards and how we deal with our law and order and stuff. I mean, we see all this stuff here. And you can also, one thing that you could also carry over is you can have that guilt thing. So we have a history of slavery here. So there's a lot of guilt about, racism, but that just bleeds over into immigration. And Courtney Turner told me about critical immigration theory, which is an offshoot of critical race theory. And I anticipate that's what's hitting Europe. And I saw in the newspaper today, there was an article that said something like Europe has a new brand of terrorism. They're afraid of a new kind of terrorism. And lo and behold, it goes into how it said specifically Afghan, Syrian, and of course, those are two of our recent targets, and Palestinian refugees who were disguised as refugees, but they were really terrorists, are coming over to Europe to target Jewish people and Israeli targets, as well as, which I'm not exactly sure what an Israeli, I think I do know. And then certain security officials that are going to be targeted by these terrorists. The story was a little crazy in the journal. One thing gets into Germany. So Italy found some Palestinians, Austria, and I think Bosnia or Bulgaria, something like that, found Kalashnikov rifles and pictures of Jewish and Israeli somethings on the phones of these Afghans and Syrians, which gave these guys, the authorities, reason to believe they were targeting those institutions and people, planning assassinations. Germany said it used to be the Islamic State, but now it's Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah. And they have been given the order to unearth a secret cache of arms that was buried there years ago. So when I see a whole list of like really big statements like that and not a lot of evidence, I've dug into a lot of these stories before. And what they presume is, or what they're telling us is like, oh, we're sure we have the evidence, we have their phone. I'm not sure it would stand up to scrutiny. I've seen people convicted or plea bargain on stuff that's like does not stand up to scrutiny. So I don't trust this story, but I see it as being significant. There was one thing in the article of the Wall Street Journal that I actually thought was downright gaslighting. This is what it said. It said the people, this was in Sweden. There was another incident in Sweden. The people they targeted are seen as representing institutions connected to what they see as the enemy state, Israel. Even though we are simply Jews living in Sweden, said Saskia Pantel, one of the targets, who is the former head of the Zionist Federation. So the Zionist Federation, I wasn't really, I've heard Zionism a lot, but I don't really know what the Zionist Federation stands for. She's the president of that. It's affiliated with the World Zionist Organization. And it's committed to promoting Zionism. I'm reading this out of their own website. Zionist idea, Zionist enterprise through Israel education is vital and positive elements of contemporary Jewish life. According to the principles articulated in the Jerusalem program, which I'm not familiar with, the manifesto is dedicated to instilling the centrality of Israel and Jerusalem, its capital, deep within Jewish consciousness, encouraging the return to Zion, fashioning an exemplary society in the Jewish state and expanding Zionist education, including Hebrew language instruction, settling the land, and combating anti-Semitism. So the fact that it's an institution that promotes settling the land and is targeted And this woman was targeted. I'm not even sure she was targeted. I'm not actually saying, all I'm just saying is it's a little, feels like gaslighting to say that she was the president of this federation and that she was targeted simply because she was Jewish, having nothing to do with the actual dispute, which is about settlements. So I'm not sure where this is going. It seems like it's going somewhere. But I did want to talk about the critical immigration theory. I just want to tell you what it is. I found an article I put in the show notes called Introducing Students to Critical Border and Migration Theories in an Era of Xenophobia by William McCorkle, College of Charleston. And it says, with the current rise of xenophobia, particularly in the U.S., critical border and migration theories need to be introduced into the classroom. They refer to a range of theories which seek to problematize, so make into a problem, the modern nationalistic perspectives on borders and migration, which is funny. You know, again, borders define a nation. So it's, of course, they're going to go hand in hand. These perspectives that center largely on the desire of the nation state instead of the rights of migrants, the desire of the nation state, like as if the nation state is a person, instead of the rights of migrants, it's also strongly correlated with the concept of open borders. This article provides a broad understanding of these critical theories from a philosophical, ethical, and economic perspective and rationale for why these more abstract and universal ideas of migration and borders should be introduced in the classroom despite the controversy they can generate. And this is of particular importance in an era where the rights of migrants are often limited or disregarded completely. Let's see. There's something else interesting here. The actual ideas about the sovereign rights of nation states to stop migration is never questioned. And the idea that even considers that human migration should be an inalienable right is not considered, et cetera, et cetera. So for me as a libertarian, I recognize the right to work and travel. Problem is, so if I have an extra bedroom, this is what Judge Napolitano used to say, and my cousin from Ireland, although he said Italy, wants to come help me with my kids, I should be able to let them live here and help me. Now, the problem is that we have removed our personal borders. You know, we have public roads and stuff like that, which, by the way, we haven't paid for yet with a 30-something trillion-dollar deficit or whatever debt. But we have removed security. We're not permitted to actually have associations that bar people. We're not. So for the most part. So we have to think about, if everybody's land is accessible to everyone, basically, or institutions and associations, you just have to make sure that you have people with similar, I mean, standards of like, you know, I don't know. Because you don't have that right to secure your own private property, then you think that you have to secure the larger border. And I can see how that's, you can't have a strict libertarian position when you don't have strict property rights. But there's also another issue, which is, of course, you know, this is common, is the welfare state, is that the people come over to access the tax dollars that the Americans have generated through the production of living in this country. And I personally think that the whole scam of redistribution is getting the middle to support the bottom. So you need a bottom and you need more bottom coming in. Some of the bottom, that economic bottom comes in, cleans your house, but some of it just goes on the dole and they consume things that government actors and even big corporations and stuff want to maximize consumption. They don't really care who's paying for it. And that goes to some other stories we're talking about today. So this idea of the right to work and travel would be fine, except for it is the nation, the borders of the nation states that define who is taxed. Like, I would say that's the very best way to define a nation state, is who is taxed and who gets the tax money. And once you do that, to open the borders to, you know, to open the system. So then it has to be a closed system. If you're going to take that money and give it away, you can't have a limitless source of extraction of that money. So, you know, I'm just trying to paint it in a picture sense, like the idea of nation states and borders are a part of the system that attracts the migration. So yes, there is a human right to work and travel, but people like this guy are no doubt in favor of the socialistic and communitarian policies that make open borders impossible. So, okay. And getting back to the humanitarian idea. So wars are generally just like this immigration thing. So the immigration is a two-sided thing where your humanitarianism and your guilt makes you want to open the borders, but your sense of fiscal and physical security makes you want to close the borders. Well, we have similar language that facilitates whatever the, you know, corpo governmental continuum wants when it comes to war, that you can say, oh, they're a security threat. They're sending terrorists over. And you also say, that's like for the Republicans and for the Democrats, you say, we'll have this humanitarian crisis. We have to like invade this other country for humanitarian reasons, like poor Ukraine, poor Gaza. See, that's the funny thing. It's like we give the arms to Israel, but now we're establishing a port in Gaza, like a physical port in Gaza to get them humanitarian aid, which to me explains why there was that crazy story last week of a humanitarian convoy getting converged upon by starving Palestinians and the Israelis opening fire, killing like 100, wounding many hundreds more. I was like, this is sounds nuts. And at the very least, you'd think they'd cover it up a little bit, but no, that is being used to justify the U.S., what I would call establishing a foothold, and my Tweeb Dean said, soon to be a stronghold in Gaza, saying there's just no way for them to get in. There's no port. Now, there is actually a port of Gaza, but it's closed by a decades-long blockade against Gaza where Israel doesn't let people trade in and out with Gaza directly. And I wonder if we would really have to do this if they had any ability to get outside goods. And maybe the port isn't deep enough or whatever, but still, like, you actually, my father is in the Navy. And when he was in the Pacific, he said, you just park, you know, you park as far out as you need to, and then you just take shuttles over. So it's definitely possible, but they've had this problem forever. And I assume that's what we're actually going to do because the temporary port is offshore. And they're saying over 500,000 people in Gaza are experiencing food scarcity. And that's the excuse that we're using, but I don't think it's going to end there. And I noticed that Biden was openly advocated a two-state solution in his State of the Union address. So, I mean, these plans are definitely years, if not decades, in the making, and that's what they want. And I'm sure that they have a plan for it. But I imagine this is going to be part of that. I wonder if that's, you know, where the Ben-Gurion Canal is going to start. I don't know. I couldn't figure out the map of exactly if it's where the new road is that we've built or Israel's built, where that port's going to be, where the Ben-Gurion Canal supposedly will end up. I don't know. So, you know, I look at this stuff. I'm telling you, the more it's just, so much of it is about money. And it seems to me it's about the best business model that the bigs have come up with. There's like big defense, big energy, big banks. Then there's big pharma, big tech, and big ag. Like those are my two tiers of the bigs. The first one is the military industrial complex. And the next is the kind of undergirding of that. And it seems to me that the best model they've come up with is they can produce things in abundance, overabundance. So you get the government to take the tax money from the productive people to buy these products and give it away to people who don't need it and would not buy it. So I consider big pharma and big defense living that model right now. So I saw, so like, you know, big pharma makes the something that the vax, whatever, that isn't, people don't really want, wouldn't pursue, may not, you know, isn't even good for them, it's bad for them. And they get the tax dollars to pay for it, and then they mandate that you consume it. I think defense is kind of similar. Like, they tax the crap out of us. They foster the defense industry. They create crises so the defense industry can sell their stuff to other countries. Then they give our aid, our tax dollars, to the other countries to buy the defense stuff or to lend them money, you know, and then enslave them. It's really a horrible system. Anyway, so today in the journal was an article that the U.S. is the world's largest arms exporter, where 40% of the world's arms come from the U.S. and are going to over 100 countries are receiving U.S. arms. Ukraine's business is booming in Ukraine, becoming a much bigger consumer of U.S. arms than previously. But this is also, there's also a ton of propaganda about how, of how Europe needs to step up and spend more money on defense, that China's huge threat. The Southeast Asian companies or the Asian countries have to spend more money on defense. And both sides say, or Trump definitely bangs that drum, or like, the European countries have to step up. And people are like, yeah, they do. And I'm like, no. They're just going to, it's not that they're going to pay us back. It's that they are going to just buy more arms. It's like an escalation. And if you think that's not true, another article in the journal today was about Macron, the French president, saying we need basically, I didn't have his exact quote, but the article said that he was implying, if not outright stating, that we need NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. In that case, you know, that's a massive escalation that Germany has said, and like, that guy capitulated to so much stuff immediately, especially with regards to Ukraine. I'm surprised he said anything. But Russia are just saying that's such an escalation. Like, that is a scary thing to do. And now we have Finland, is it, in NATO? Sweden just joined NATO with a lot of, they produce arms too. It's getting scary over there. And, you know, with us moving towards physical presence in Gaza, that's scary too. And it just feels like, this, it's like a defense juggernaut, and so many articles I've been reading are about the money, about the defense industry, about our, you know, how much we're spending, how much we're subsidizing other people's spending on it. So, and a big defense contractor is Boeing. So when I see all this stuff about Boeing, I'm thinking, you know, it seems like a psyop. That Alaska Air door just seemed weird and not true. And then, you know, they're saying, oh, Boeing is so bad. But then I uncovered, I think at the last show, like, the FAA was definitely had a role to play in the malfunction of the system that caused the crashes. Now, it was bad. I'm not saying it wasn't bad, but I wasn't sure it was evidence of Boeing circling the drain or whatever. And I wouldn't put it past them, where they get such a huge percentage of their revenue from the government, to play along, even if it hurts their reputation, or, you know, might not hurt their bottom line, or might not hurt the bottom line of the people who have the power to go along with it, let's just say. Anyway, so there was another incident in the newspaper today. A Chilean airline, LATAM, L-A-T-A-M, although it was Chilean, it was in Auckland. And the pilot said that the screens went blank, and the passengers say that the plane just dropped and people hit the roof and got hurt and had to get medical attention. And I actually had a pilot tell me a long time ago, always keep your seatbelt fastened, because turbulence can do that. And that's, people can get killed because they hit their heads. So I always keep my seatbelt on the plane for that reason. But they're saying there's no way it was turbulence, because this, you know, they said it was screens. But I'm still like, I don't know. How can I verify that? I can't. But here's something that happened. that was in the news today. And this makes you start to think that this is for reals. However, it's everywhere in the news, everywhere on NPR, everything. They definitely want us to know about this. So it's that there was a whistleblower, a Boeing whistleblower, who said that he was retaliated against after he retired, even despite being protected by whistleblower statutes. So he was suing Boeing. His name is John Barnett. He was suing Boeing just to have his day in court. And he said he had to blow the whistle because he couldn't sleep at night, had to make sure this was out in the open. So he was in Charleston giving a deposition that he was going to testify on his own behalf in this case. And he didn't show up for the second day, I think it was, or what he was supposed to show up for in the court. And they went looking for him and found him shot to death in his car outside his hotel room. And they're, you know, the official, or so far it's being called a suicide. But it seems crazy and obvious. And how can that be? So for me, like, you would do that and make it obvious if it's a message to other whistleblowers. So like, I can definitely see what the implication is here. But the fact that it's so obvious what the implication is makes me wonder. So this is one of those things. It's super complicated. Time will tell what's real and what's not real about this. But I mean, this is really happening. And actually, another person said that people are talking about how Boeing outsourced their software development and testing and stuff to India in return for contracts. So this says, sales are another reason to send work overseas. In exchange for an $11 billion order in 2005 from Air India, Boeing promised to invest $1.7 billion in Indian companies, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know about that. I'm not sure. I don't know what exactly is going on. And they did say that they had not outsourced that system, the MCAS system, that was responsible for those crashes. So we'll just keep an eye on this story. It seems to be a new development every day. And before I get to comments and other stories, I want to tell you a couple of things. Let me see. What do I want to tell you? Oh, okay. Truhemp Science, you know how much I love Truhemp Science CBD. People tell me CBD is bullshit, but I know that they're not using Truhemp Science products because I've never heard that from anybody who I like to send people the gummies because I feel like it's a great alternative to having wine during the week. You sleep better, not worse. You wake up feeling good. I like the zero THC gummies. But they have a new product, which is on the way to me, which I'm trying. And I actually pay for this stuff. Like, he'll give you a discount and stuff, but I like it. I buy it. But I haven't tried Hypnotica yet. So I am getting a free sample of that in the mail. It is, according to our guy, Chris, who's a huge supporter of the show, an excellent end-of-the-day relaxation tool that may inspire a lifted sense during your evening routines. So I'm dying to see what that is like. And you can have it. Chris gave me a promo code, Monica. Looks like it's all caps. Try that. The first 100 customers to spend $80 or more will get a free sample of Hypnotica. So I love the products. I love the brownies, the cookies, the gummies, and everything else. So usually I think on the website, it tells you what different things are for. I even like the lotion, the body rubs. So if you want to support me, you can support Chris at truehempscience.com. And use the promo code Monica. So, all right, let's see if there are some comments. Let's see. The Boeing whistleblower was just found dead. Yes, yes. It's not me, says, it's not my name, says, always have a backup parachute. John says the Gaza port would be a great military presence and access point to Gazan oil. Yes. So I was wondering if Gaza was slated to be a resort, but if it's oil, yeah, that's right. Okay. So let us hit a few more stories. Oh, one thing I wanted to tell y'all is I was I was watching The Getaway with Steve McQueen. I've been a little bit on a Steve McQueen kick, I guess. I don't know. I've seen the few good movies of his. I have not yet rewatched The Blob, so we'll see. That'll be my last Steve McQueen movie. But I was watching The Getaway, and there was a point during which, like, somebody shot the security guard, but his gun was still in reach. So I was like, kick the gun, you know, like, get it away. And my mobile device, whose intelligence is named after the Stanford Research Institute, I don't want to say her name because I know she's listening, because I wasn't talking to her. I didn't say her name. And lo, when I told the television to kick the gun, my phone asked me if I wanted it to call emergency services. So you think that just saying her name is the way to wake her up, but who knows how many other buzzwords they are. Apparently, G-U-N is one of them. I really hope. It's freaking me out. I mean, not that I should be freaked out about, like, obviously we know these things are, like, constantly on and listening, but that was a little weird because she started talking to me. Okay. So let's talk about Biden's budget proposal. I don't really want to get into that too much because it's really just a signal. It's not really anything that's going to happen. And, like, we forget this guy is an executive. He's not a legislator. He's an executive. Why we give the president so much power to set policy and everything? Really, it's a distortion. But he just had the State of the Union address, and it was like a campaign speech. I feel like that's totally unconstitutional. Like, the State of the Union address is supposed to be true. It's supposed to give us information. So I would say he's, like, wrong on both of those points. It was 100% useless, and it's an unfair advantage against the opponent. I think it exacerbates the incumbency problem. So, one of the things that really made me crazy in his speech was when he was saying that it's time for billionaires to pay their fair share of taxes. And I just would like to know what fair means in that context, because I'm thinking billionaires probably, the way finance and investment works, they do tend to be, like, I would think they should be taxed more than, like, earned income that you're wage slaving for. When they make an investment, they can get, it's called carried interest or something, whatever. I think they get, like, they only have a 20% tax rate as if it were an investment, but really it's compensation for their work. It's a screwy thing. Everyone says they're going to get rid of it, but of course they never do. But barring that, my guess is that most of the money that billionaires have has already been taxed. And certainly in the beginning, as a wage earner, I don't know. I mean, I have to do the work, but it's not like those billions have arrived untaxed to those people. And regardless, what is the fair share? Is the fair share the amount of dollars it would cost to pay for what they're getting from government? In which case, I think people like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, who own massive, massive tracts of land in this country that I believe they expect, or the value of that is greatly enhanced by the fact that it's protected by the U.S. Air Force, you know, government security, whatever form that is. So, yeah, I mean, maybe that should be big, or because they can use the courts to enforce contracts. I don't know if how much of your court expenses you have to pay when you're doing that, if, like, loser has to pay or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, they definitely use it. I'd like to know, there are such things as property taxes. They're probably paying property taxes. What does fair mean in that context? And I think it just means more. And it just drives me crazy when they lump people who work for a living in this other category, whatever, it doesn't matter. It always just bugs me. But fair, like, I just, Anyway, so his plan is to have a $7.3 trillion budget. I believe that's up from $6.9 last year. And yet he gets to say he's going to trim the deficit because the budget, if you raise taxes enough so that the gap between, you know, how much your borrowing goes down, you can say you're trimming the deficit, even though the spending continues to skyrocket. $7.3 trillion in U.S. government spending. Think about that. What are they spending it on? The majority of it is redistribution. I would say, like, defense is so much of that is not truly defensive. I think maybe two-thirds of it is, like, what I would kind of call corporate welfare. A lot of the other money is wealth transfers, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. There is, you know, I think probably $2 trillion of it is actual infrastructure stuff, or like legitimate functions of government, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, it's outrageous. And he's increasing military spending, of course, because of Ukraine and Gaza and all the people who are on the border trying to invade us. Like, that's why you would, you know, the Gaza and Ukraine are not our wars to fight, even though I guess they are since we've been promoting them. Anyway, so in all this war propaganda in the Wall Street Journal was a little spotlight of Jake Sullivan, who's the national security advisor. And he's the youngest ever. And I think he may be poised to be the longest serving. And but of course, they paint him in this light of like, he's just a public servant trying to juggle a lot of balls. And he really tries so hard. And his job is so tough, but he's so blah, blah, blah. And this is his quote that they highlighted. "For me, the metric of success is a series of simple questions. Will America have a stronger industrial and innovation base when I leave than when I came?" Sullivan told the Journal. "Will our alliances be more vital, and will our competitors and adversaries be more vexed than when I came?" So I don't know if the national security advisor should feel like industrial industry and innovation is his number one priority. That is not a free enterprise system, if you ask me. But it doesn't matter what he says or how they paint it. Here's who he is. He was born in 1976. He previously served as director of policy to Obama, the national security advisor to Biden when he was vice president, the deputy chief of staff to Hillary Clinton at the Department of State. He was a senior advisor on Iran nuclear negotiations. He was an advisor to Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. He's a visiting professor at Yale. He attended Yale. He majored in international studies and political science and was awarded the Alpheus Henry Snow Prize. He was inducted into Phi Beta Kappa. I couldn't tell if he was Skull and Bones. I don't think that's the same. He graduated summa cum laude with distinction in 98 with a BA. He won a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Magdalen College in Oxford. And of course, the Rhodes Scholarship is such a huge red flag. He studied international relations there. He was awarded a Marshall Scholarship, but had to choose, so he chose Rhodes. While at Oxford, he was the managing editor of the Oxford International Review. He graduated with a master's of philosophy. He has a JD from Yale. And he is a member of the Truman National Security Project. I believe he's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He won the Truman Scholarship. He worked for Brookings Institution. President Strobe Talbot at the Yale Center for the Study of Globalization. So I think he worked for Strobe Talbot when he was the Brookings Institution president. Regardless, you get the idea of what this guy is all about, for sure, right? I mean, he is deep state all the way. And if you wonder what that really means in the position of national security advisor, I would like to read for you a quote by James Jones, who was the national security advisor in 2009. So I guess that's Obama. Let me read you this. He was at the Council of Foreign Relations saying this, and it was on their website when I pulled it. It's probably gone by now, but Council of Foreign Relations is what Hillary Clinton called the mothership. So he said, "Thank you for that wonderful tribute to Henry Kissinger yesterday. Congratulations. As the most recent National Security Advisor of the United States, I take my daily orders from Dr. Kissinger, filtered down through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger, who is also here. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council that exists today." Okay. Kissinger, Scowcroft, and Berger, I believe, were all National Security Advisors, or two out of three of them were. None of them had a position in the U.S. government in 2009. So he was taking his orders from Kissinger, Scowcroft, and Berger. And that is the chain of command, the legacy, the unbroken NSA, the nature of what Jake Sullivan is doing. I would be very, very surprised if that changed dramatically over the past 15 years, because what he was talking about was something that was already in existence for probably 30 years. I don't think he lasted long, that James Jones, but he certainly knew where his bread was buttered. But perhaps his lips were a little too loose on that one. And so should I hit on this one little weird thing about Kate Middleton? So I don't really care about this stuff. Obviously, people are laughing at me, but I got this book thanks to Joni McGarry, and recommended it to me, and thought Courtney Turner and I would both like it. It's called The Vice of Kings: How Socialism, Occultism, and the Sexual Revolution Engineered a Culture of Abuse by Jason Horsley. So I was kind of interested in that. And I always wonder what's, you know, King Charles, Chucky III, used to be friends with Jimmy Savile, who was definitely part of what this book is about. And they're talking about him having cancer, Harry and Meghan split. Kate Middleton hasn't been seen in a couple of months, because certainly not officially, since she had abdominal surgery. But what really tipped it for me was, again, in the Journal today, is this article. So when it gets to the Journal, I consider it haute propaganda. Like, that's why I read the Journal. This is stuff that is officially on the agenda, the propaganda agenda. This is like the propaganda of record, let's call it. So when it's in there, I'm like, okay, they're not going to call me a conspiracy theorist for repeating what's in there. And it's that there was a picture released on British Mother's Day of Kate and her three kids, which was clearly Photoshopped. So the implication is that she's so unwell that she could not appear in a photo like that, a fresh photo like that. So they just pieced it together. And it was such a bad job of doing it. They're like, oh, it's like an AI feature on the iPhone. And she just, you know, was dashing it off. I think she herself said, "I just dashed it off," which is ridiculous. It's as believable as Trump dashing off his own tweets. I mean, this is the most highly controlled society in human history. There's no way that the most powerful people aren't just dashing stuff off, and all the billionaires around them have their fingers crossed, hoping for the best. Like, there's absolutely no chance this stuff isn't, in my opinion, totally orchestrated. But why? Why are they freaking people out about this stuff, or creating mystery, conspiracy theories? And so I asked, you know, my tweeps for a little twisdom on it. And lo, I got linked to an article on Miri's Massive Missives on Substack. I'll put it in the show notes. And it was such a great article. I might want to talk to Miri about it. She's saying that when they usher in the new guard, I guess the new labor guy, I should remember the name, I can't remember, that she thinks a way for him to gain legitimacy is going to be to knock down a couple of the pegs of the stool that keep the opposition so anti-establishment, so anti-government. And that is the, you know, whatever fuckery of the royal family or the pedos on high or whatever that is. The Julian Assange, you know, injustice, which of course I think the focus should be on Ross Ulbricht, about whom I have no doubt of his authenticity. And that's Ulbricht, if you want to look that up. And then the COVID vaccines. So she thinks if this guy can, if the monarchy is shrunk or eliminated entirely, it would have such a massive credibility boost that the guy would get a lot. You know, it's kind of like electing Obama. You know, it's like, yes, like finally, it's obvious. You can tell by looking at the guy that, or that was Stacey Abrams' line. You could tell by looking at me that I can be trusted. So it was very interesting. And maybe that's what's going on. I don't know, but that's a psyop. So there is probably a reason, and it's probably not just to sell tabloid newspapers. And that's it. Oh, and by the way, when I was reading that Jake Sullivan bio, like I hadn't seen a bio like that since Stacey Abrams. So if you think she's some grassroots chick who's like from the sticks and blah, blah, blah. Oh my gosh. Read her bio sometime if you can find it. It's like that. Anyway. All right. So I think that's it. Do I have, yes. Keir Starmer. Yes, yes, yes. Sir Keir Starmer. That's extra funny. Very, very funny. Oh, Jimmy Savile was knighted? Wow. Sunny. Okay. All right. Well, that's it. Let's wrap it up. Thank you so much. And you know what would be great? It would be great if you would subscribe on any of your favorite podcasting platforms and give me a review. Because really what, I'm not putting anything behind a paywall right now. If you're listening with commercials, you can contribute, especially on iTunes right now, or go to rockfin.com/Monica Perez and join up there. That will help support me. But and I just want to pay for the show. But I would like to get some reach because it's, you know, it's how I spend my time and I want to make sure that it's worthwhile and that it's reaching, you know, there's no reason not to reach more people with the same stuff. And the goal is just to kind of let you know about the news and also keep your feet on the ground, your teenagers or whatever. I should probably never use vulgarity if I want you to let your teenagers listen to it. But I just feel like it's a good way to get news without, without the all the propaganda agendas. Anyway, okay, until next time, thank you so much. This is The Monica Perez Show.